I also want to welcome our special guests today. We have a 8th grade class here from the Denver Academy of Torah. Some of them are, if I understand, are aspiring lawyers. They are studying the book To Kill a Mockingbird in their class, and as all of you know, I'm sure remember, there's a very important trial in that book, so they wanted to see how things really go in a courtroom as opposed to what they just read about in the book. Counsel, I assume all of you have gotten the instructions for our oral arguments. There's 15 minutes per side. There's a red light and a yellow light. And the yellow light comes on, you have 5 minutes left. If you want to reserve time, that's your heads up. Please stay close to the podium because all of the arguments are recorded for the State Judicial Branch website. And in that regard, if you are mentioning the name of a juvenile or a sex assault victim, please try to remember to use initials. I think that is an issue in the first case we have on the docket today. There is a toggle switch on the podium that raises it up and down, which you can use. And finally, if anybody in the audience has cell phones, pagers, or other electronic devices that might go off, please put them on mute or turn them off. And with that, counsel, in the case of People versus Childress, please begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Griffin. I'm appearing today on behalf of Kenneth Childress. Mr. Childress is challenging his convictions for Class 3 felony child abuse and Class 4 felony vehicular assault and his 36-year prison sentence. I'd like to start with the first issue, but I'm hoping to have time to talk about the complicity issue, and I will take your questions on any of the issues. But to start with the child abuse issue, the statute says one who permits a child to be unreasonably placed in a situation that poses a threat of injury to his health commits child abuse. And this is a crime regardless of whether any injury occurs to the child. If the conduct is knowing, reckless, and the child abuse results in serious bodily injury, it's a Class 3 felony, which is what's charged here. If the child abuse results in a non-serious injury or no injury, it's a misdemeanor offense.
Wasn't the defendant acquitted of the reckless?
That was the vehicular assault.
I'm sorry.
You're right, but that was, you confused me for
a minute. I'm sorry.
So the first problem with the child abuse conviction is that we asked for a bill of particulars because we wanted the DA to tell us precisely which act of child abuse that was in the discovery, in the allegations, was the one that they were going forward on for the charge.
Did the complaint or the indictment specify that this was, I guess it would be a felony three, that is serious bodily injury was involved?
Yes, it did.
So didn't that tell you that serious bodily injury was the only act of child abuse that was at issue in the case? And that put you on notice, I should say?
Well, it told us that they would have to prove serious bodily injury. But the problem was that there were numerous allegations of acts that could support a conviction for misdemeanor child abuse in evidence, and we just wanted clarification.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
But wasn't the only act that could have caused serious bodily injury when the defendant put the KC in the back seat without being restrained, and they took off with BL driving? I mean, there's no other cause of the serious bodily injury, is there? Nothing else in which resulted in serious bodily injury?
I think that's right.
Okay.
Yes. The problem is, okay, so we wanted this specification. The DA refused to specify. And the problem is that the DA was saying that it was all of his conduct. All of the things he did on the day are the charged child abuse. He wasn't saying it was just when he put him in the car, that's the crime, that's what we're charging. He was saying it's everything.
It was covering a 9-hour period.
Yes, exactly. And we raised...
One of the paragraphs of the statute allows charge for a pattern of child abuse, right? But that paragraph was not charged?
I don't believe that was charged, no.
Okay.
And I haven't researched what that requires, but I don't believe that was charged in this case. But my point is that we raised this issue well before trial. We were not laying in the weeds. We were not waiting for Jeopardy to attach and then being cute about it. We were saying, look, we just please want you to tell us, you know, what it is. And at that point, They could have added misdemeanor counts if they wanted to. I mean, that's the risk of asking for specificity, is they could actually say, hey, you're right, I'm going to add charges. And that way, if they had added charges, then the jury would have known exactly what charge goes to what, and we would have had verdicts on each act. But the prosecutor said, no, I can go forward on, you know, everything this father did over this 9-hour period and give it all to the jury and tell them that that's all child abuse, and you all can see that, that he suffered serious bodily injury, because there's no dispute that he did suffer serious bodily injury at the end of the night, and convict him. And so the problem is that the jurors didn't have to agree on an act, and they were able to convict based on conduct that didn't cause the serious bodily injury, which leads into the next problem, is that the causation wasn't made clear enough. And again, the defense really did everything they're supposed to in this case, because you can take issue with the wording of some of the instructions and say, well, you know, maybe this could have been said better. But boy, did they ask for everything they needed to ask for and submit interrogatories and submit instructions. Because we submitted an instruction, an interrogatory that said you have to find that the defendant caused injury. Did the defendant cause injury? And if so, did he cause serious bodily injury? Did his act of child abuse cause injury? Which is how the statute is worded, that the child abuse had to cause the injury.
The jury was instructed, and by this time I think the prosecution had elected.
No, I don't think the prosecutor ever elected, Judge.
All right. The jury was instructed that the offense was that he permitted a child to be unreasonably placed in a situation that posed a threat of injury and which resulted in serious injury.
Right.
Given the addition of the language which resulted in serious injury, why wouldn't the jury from that understand that it was, he was charged with, was putting him in the, as Judge Miller said, putting him in the car with the 17-year-old driving? Well, that's the only act that resulted in serious injury.
That statutory language actually tells them that the situation had to result in injury. It's very vague, that I put him in a situation and then that situation resulted in injury. It's just not clear. We just wanted to make it more clear. And Dunaway from the Supreme Court says that there's got to be this causal connection between not just the situation, but the act. The act of putting the child into the situation has to be what then results in the serious bodily injury.
So how could the jury, can we, using a case like Thomas, say the jury must have agreed that that was the incident? Because, for example, the ride from Lakewood back to Aurora when defendant was driving was a dangerous situation, to be sure, but didn't result in serious bodily injury. So the jury couldn't have found that was the act that caused the child abuse.
Well, I mean, the DA argued in closing, and this is part of the reason I say he never elected. And certainly, an election is normally made formally on the record. That didn't happen. But it also didn't happen in closing, because he told the jury, look, what the defendant's acts that put this child at risk were a few. One was when he took the child to the party with drinking and drugs and guns in the first place. So he's going at the very beginning at 2:00 in the afternoon, he's saying that my client, the child's father, put him in this dangerous situation, and then the jury's told, well, the situation then just has to result in serious bodily injury. We wanted to make it more clear. And the judge wouldn't give that instruction, and the judge also wouldn't require unanimous verdicts. Now, the other issue that's related to this is that we had this interrogatory that we tendered and a graduated verdict form that required the finding of causation and the type of injury that my client's child abuse actually caused. And the effect of the interrogatory was to give lessers. We wanted misdemeanor lessers because we wanted the jury to have the choice to say, well, what did his child abuse cause? Regular injury, serious bodily injury, no injury. And then we would get the appropriate verdict for the crime that was actually committed as found by the jury. The defense is entitled to lesser instructions as a theory of defense if viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant, if there's any basis to convict on the lesser and acquit on the greater. And I think clearly there was in this case, and so the court also erred in refusing to give the instruction on that ground.
wasn't the court probably relying on the fact that the only thing that resulted in specific or serious bodily injury was BL's drive? And there was quite a bit of testimony about BL's drive. I mean, I think both BL testified about it, as did HT. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I believe so.
So, that, you know, this wasn't something that was just dropped out of the blue on the jury. It was discussed at some length. So isn't that part of what the trial judge was thinking, is that it's clear that that's what caused serious bodily injury? Why do we need to get any more specific?
Well, I think that's what the judge was thinking, but I don't think that's right. And, mm-hmm. and the reason is, if you look at the Dunaway case basically rejects the thinking of the trial court, because what the trial court was saying on the record anyway is, look, this kid suffered serious bodily injury. There's no dispute about that. How could they possibly find your client guilty of any crime that doesn't result in serious bodily injury? And Dunaway said that was the same reasoning used there. And Dunaway said, no, the mere fact that you can find that the defendant did place the child in a situation which created this threat, and the fact that the child suffered serious bodily injury, doesn't establish proof of his guilt, because you've got to have the causal connection between his act and the guilt. And here I'm saying we needed the jury to make the finding of the causal connection. So, I mean, that's my argument. Maybe you just don't agree with it.
Counsel, can I get you to switch gears and talk about the complicitor liability?
Yes.
And I've noticed that the Supreme Court seems to have been extending complicitor liability in cases of reckless manslaughter and criminal negligence. And I wondered if you could distinguish those cases and tell me why we shouldn't find them persuasive in extending here as well.
Well, I think you're right that a number of years ago, there was a lot of extension going on back when Wheeler came out, which is the case, I think, from 1989, saying that you can be a complicitor to a criminally negligent homicide. But I actually think that what's been going on since then has been a little bit more of a backtracking. Because if you look at Bogdanoff and Grissom, which are the more recent cases, Bogdanoff really kind of backs off of Wheeler a little bit, because Wheeler says that as long as you know that the other guy's going to engage in criminal conduct, you're guilty. There's a little bit of sloppy language, I would say, that Bogdanoff does not approve of, and that they disapprove of when this court kind of picked up and ran with that language in other cases. And what Bogdanoff said was, you can be a complicitor to criminally negligent conduct, but you've got to have that mens rea. So there's a mens rea. You've got to act with act with criminal negligence yourself, but you also have to know that the other guy is disregarding, I forget the exact language, but disregarding a substantial risk or something like that, that death will occur. So there's quite a lot of awareness that's required still to be a complicitor to reckless or criminally negligent conduct, as much as I disagree that you should be able to be a complicitor to either of those things. There is still something for the complicitor liability to latch onto in those
a culpable
contexts.
Mental state, in other
yes.
words, which you don't have with a strict liability crime.
Not whatsoever. And so if you were to actually be the court that extended complicity to strict liability, you would be the court saying that not only are we going to punish the person who's encouraging, say, or sitting in the car the same, even though they didn't commit any of the crime, we're also going to punish them the same for a class 3 felony, even though they had no culpable mental state whatsoever. And I don't think that's where we want to go, and I don't think that's where Colorado's going to go. And I don't think there's any basis for that, because if you look at the legislative intent in writing the complicity statute, they put a mens rea right in the complicity statute.
Bottom line is, I think, that there can be no complicity in a strict liability crime.
Absolutely.
There can be complicity in a criminal negligent or a reckless crime, but there
under
can
the
be
law.
No, under those two cases, but there has been no case that says there can be complicity, but there's no case that says there cannot be complicity in a strict liability crime.
I think that's because they don't ever try.
Except in this case.
Right, sure, yeah, right. They tried it in this case, and so here we are. But really, I think it's just
so
very
just to take that stuff out, if a person encourages somebody to drink and drink and drink and now get in the car and drive, now go driving while you're drunk, and that person that's driving is stopped for DUI or arrest of you, the person that encouraged it and maybe even supplied the liquor and encouraged the driving can't be held guilty or can be found liable as a complicitor.
Not for the actual offense of vehicular assault. Maybe they would be an accomplice beforehand or soliciting the crime, or I have a feeling there would be some ground to find them guilty of something. We're talking about convicting somebody of the actual crime and giving them the full punishment, the same as the person who commits the crime.
Reckless endangerment, maybe?
I'm sure they'd think of something. Yeah. I'm going to save my last few seconds. Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Carl Spettigill, attorney registration 39208, and I represent the people in this matter. I want to take a brief moment to just talk about a little bit about the facts that took place here. I know the court, I'm sure, is familiar, but just for everybody's reference, we have a defendant here who took his 3-year-old son, Casey, to a party with his 18-year-old son, BL, and began drinking heavily. After drinking all night with BL, the defendant eventually decided to drive to his home in his older son's girlfriend's car, and they were all in the car together, Casey, his older son BL, the girlfriend, and we were all driving back to his home in Aurora, which was about a 30-minute drive. All the while he's driving very recklessly with his son. There's conflicting testimony whether or not he was restrained or in a car seat. There was definitely no car seat, but there's conflicting testimony about whether or not he was restrained in the backseat of the car. Then upon hearing that someone had pulled a gun back at the party that they were originally at, everyone gets back into the car, this time with BL in the driver's seat, and the defendant is in the back seat with his 3-year-old and his drunken teenage son driving at high rates of speed, 80 to 100 miles per hour, driving recklessly, while his 3-year-old is standing right next to him. He's not in a car seat, he's not restrained in any way. And not surprisingly, BL collided with another car. Casey was seriously injured. He had a torn spleen, a broken jaw, bleeding in his brain, and significant facial lacerations. We're talking multiple surgeries here to correct the injuries sustained from the crash.
Counsel, you've just listed a whole bunch of things that Dad did, which were not good things.
Correct.
How was the jury supposed to know what facts you were relying on for this child abuse claim?
Well, the purpose, so let's talk about first the bill of particulars and unanimity issue. The purpose of a bill of particulars is to put the defendant on notice of what he's going to have to defend against. The defendant was charged here with one act of child abuse. He could have been charged with many more, you know, as evidenced by the facts of this case, but the prosecution elected to only charge him with one, that being the one act that resulted in serious bodily injury. And so to the extent that the defendant was on notice from that point on, that he knew that while all these other things happened during the course of the evening, the prosecution essentially was saying, I don't want to be limited in the way that I present this case by dropping all of a sudden, you know, dropping this instance of the car crash out of the blue without any context to this jury. Essentially, it would make no sense. It's sort of a res geste concept that I'm not going to be able to explain why this kid was outside this home in Aurora with his father and the son and the other girlfriend at 2 o'clock in the morning driving towards the party where there was going to be a gun. It wouldn't make sense without all these other contextual facts.
So the prosecution wasn't saying, look at the entire 9-hour period, and from that entire 9-hour period and all those acts that occurred there, reach unanimity?
I think what happened was at the pretrial hearing, the prosecution was not willing to limit itself at that point. It was still possible that they could have elected to charge other instances of child abuse at that point. You know, they weren't willing to limit their factual scenario because they weren't sure, you know, they could have charged more at that point. However, at the point of trial, I think what they were saying is, look at the evening in question as a whole. Let's look at how all of these events led up to the point at which the defendant disregarded this substantial and unjustifiable risk that his son would end up, you know, with serious bodily injury as a result of his decision making, and that's exactly what happened here. And I don't believe that there's any question that the jury understood, and no,
excuse me, we're supposed to presume that the jury understood that that was exactly what happened here and this is what they were charging.
The problem I have is that the prosecution invited them to reach their decision without even considering BL's driving and the failure to restrain the son. Ms. Griffin pretty well summarized the points that were made in the closing argument on the child abuse claim, and no mention at all is made of BL's driving back to Lakewood or little KC being unrestrained. So, what the prosecution argued was, based on this situation, which was going to the party with drugs and liquor, getting in the car unrestrained, and BL driving recklessly, that he suffered serious bodily injury and he's therefore guilty of the child abuse charge. Under those circumstances, how can we be certain that the jury didn't rely on the facts that were argued by the prosecution?
Well, the facts, I think that they were instructed that the facts argued in closing argument, that the closing arguments were not evidence, that they were argument. And I think the jury, we need to presume that they understood. I think it would be a far-reaching conclusion to for this court to believe that, you know, that BL, or I'm sorry, KC being put in the dryer then resulted in serious bodily injury. I think the jury, I think we need to presume that they were able to kind of compartmentalize the evening and say these were all other instances, and while those were never charged, here's what actually resulted in the serious bodily injury, which is a direct element of the offense we have to find here.
But since there was no causation instruction, couldn't the jury have concluded, well, defendant drove recklessly and taken him back to Aurora, which then required him to be driven back to Lakewood, and so it was really defendant's fault for driving him back to Aurora.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question?
Yes. Why couldn't the jury have concluded, based on the way the case was argued and presented, that it was dad's fault for driving the kid back to Aurora, and then he had to go back to and the only reason he got into his accident is because dad drove him back to Aurora, and then apparently when driving back, he gets into an accident. Why couldn't they say, well, that must be the cause of the injury, dad's driving him to Aurora, which led to his ultimately getting injured?
Well, I think all of that is relevant evidence towards how he got there in the first place. So to the extent that it is res justa, it is contextual. How did that kid get to Aurora? Why is he there at 2 o'clock in the morning? How did he get to the point where that he is then placed in the position where he's in the backseat unrestrained while the drunken teenage son is driving? Well, that's how. The dad took him there, drove recklessly, got in there, and then on the way back, it was the son who actually caused the serious bodily, or who, you know, got into the accident that caused the serious bodily injury. All the while, but I feel that the jury is going to be able to understand that the element of the crime that requires a serious bodily injury is going to be the different, is going to be kind of the flag point for when they post the act that they find to be the illegal act, the child abuse act.
Does it matter that the jury found a defendant not guilty of the drive back to Lakewood involving recklessness?
I don't believe so.
That's another way.
Six of the jurors thought the reckless conduct was driving from Lakewood to Aurora when the father was driving. Three of the jurors thought the reckless conduct was put him in the back seat unrestrained on that drive. Three other jurors thought the reckless conduct was driving back to Lakewood with the son driving. All found reckless conduct. Is that unanimity? If the jurors found that, and they could under these instructions, does that satisfy the requirements of unanimity?
I think what we have to... The presumption here is we have to presume that they unanimously agreed on the act, correct? And so to the extent that if we're going to say, was it, you know, the last 5 minutes of the drive to Aurora, or was it the whole drive back, or, you know, I think that number one, we can't really sit as a 13 jury and refocus on what it was that they exactly agreed on. Well, we have to presume that this jury understood the jury instruction before them. And I think that from these instructions, it is clear that the act at issue had to result in serious bodily injury. And this jury is not going to think, because the defendant driving there, although reckless and although terrible, that he was driving drunk with his son in the back, it didn't result in serious bodily injury. The only act that resulted in serious bodily injury was when the defendant allowed he and his son to get back into the car while his drunken teenage son drove the car back to the party.
And was the argument made as clearly at trial as you just made it to us right now?
I think it could have probably been made a little clearer. However, we're saying closing argument is not evidence. And I think the jury, we have to presume that they understood the instruction. It was the one bodily injury, there was one act, and they're not going to, I don't think the prosecution should be punished for not charging him with 16 different acts of child abuse. This defendant acted so horrendously the whole night that he's now going to be more difficult to prosecute. That seems, you know, it seems kind of counterintuitive that you would say that, you know, because he was, negligent or reckless in so many different ways, that you have to then, you know, lay it out, you know, to that degree of certainty in every single instance when there's only one charge here. We only have one charge and one abuse. So, you know, it shouldn't be an issue of confusion. I don't see how there really was or could have been an issue of confusion for the jury. I'd like to talk briefly about the issue of causation. As defense counsel pointed out, the child abuse statute is kind of broken up into two parts. We have the act element and the injury element. Here, the defendant can be prosecuted. So a defendant, as is relevant here, can either be prosecuted for actually causing the injury, so the injury element, or for endangering the child, the endangerment clause. And then you have the injury part that kind of attaches, you know, felony classification to that. Now, what I think is important to note here is the Dunaway case, because the defendant really hammers that home in their brief, and I think it's important to distinguish that, because this was a highly fact-specific situation in Dunaway, because that defendant was charged under both subsections, so that he both caused the injury directly by shaking the baby, and also by endangering the child by prohibiting the girlfriend from seeking medical attention. So I feel like the crux of the issue there is that the whole injury was encompassed by his direct causing the injury. So the causation required in the Dunaway case, they're basically saying you can't find causation here because all of that injury so far, according to the evidence, was attributed to your physical cause, you know, your direct causing the evidence. There was no link between the endangerment and the injury. Now, what I'm saying here is that's simply not the case, because what happened here was the defendant placed the child in a risky situation and it resulted in bodily injury, which is exactly what the statute requires. So to give you an example, if we say a defendant puts his child in a shark tank filled with sharks and the child is bitten, resulting in bodily injury, is it not the defendant's fault? Was he not endangering the child, or is it the shark's fault? You know, it's the whole causation issue there, that the whole point of the endangerment clause is to attach criminal liability to someone who makes these decisions, these risky decisions on behalf of their child, and places them in a substantial and unjustifiable risk. So to the extent that the defendant is arguing that the causation instruction should have been provided, I believe this instruction tracked the language of the statute. It was clear that this resulted in the serious bodily injury here, and this court should have no problem.
Turn, if you will, to the complicity.
Complicity. Okay, so as the court already noted, I'm going to skip some of my argument because I'm running low on time, but basically what the people's position here is that while I understand it may seem disquieting to think that criminal liability can attach to someone without any criminal intent, but what we're saying here is that strict liability is simply a different framework. Strict liability crimes require some basic mental state wherein a person must commit a voluntary act. It still requires a showing of some volitional amount, some minimal amount of conscious mental activity requiring effort or determination. Okay, so to the extent that it's not a statutory mental element, there's still this basic minimal element here. And all that the people are saying is that Bogdanov, all of the case law requires the same mental state.
Actually, let me just ask you about that. Bogdanov very clearly says that the complicitor must have the same culpable mental state, not just mental state, but same culpable mental state as is necessary for the underlying crime. And here there is no culpable mental state.
Well,
so are you asking us to revise Bogdanov and say, they didn't really mean culpable, they just meant mental state?
No, I'm just saying I think it extends, because I think that to the degree that it's a volitional act, that you're, that you, that the minimum requirement that you have a conscious mental activity that you're saying, I'm going to do this act, recognizing that there's no malice and there's no knowing, there's no recklessness, there's no negligence. However, there's still this, you have to have a volitional act on your part, and that the defendant merely needs to know of that. He knows that this is happening.
But that's not consistent with the definition of culpable mental state in the statutes, is it? Because that's limited to intentional knowing, recklessness, and criminal negligence.
Correct. But I would say that, but to the extent that you can extended in the same manner, I think it would apply conceptually in the same way.
Does it matter that Bogdanov says that the concept of Wheeler, which got into this line of thought you're thinking, applies only to criminal negligence and recklessness? They explicitly limited to that, and I think Grissom pretty much follows that.
I think if you look at Fisher, I mean, they extended to a strict liability crime, obviously based on the fact that felony murder has an underlying felony, but, you know, being that the analogy is the same, we're talking about a strict liability crime,
I don't think the analogy is the same. There was a culpable mental state, which was, I'm going to commit a burglary or a robbery or a kidnapping or a sexual assault. All things have a very serious culpable mental state. Nothing like that here for DUI and vehicular.
But I think the analysis is the same to the extent that what a strict liability crime is, you're trying to effectively regulate an activity in the area where individuals' acts may have grave consequences upon the public at large. So you're trying to fight like a societal evil, and that's why no mental state attaches. And yet you want to also be able to, you know, punish the, I'm sorry, it seems I'm out of time. Do you mind if I finish my
thought? Finish your sentence.
You want to be able to punish somebody who is, like Judge Richman gave the example of, you know, DUI, that is encouraging this behavior, that's a societal evil. Why wouldn't you want some sort of criminal liability to attach?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I just want to tell the court the first purpose of our criminal code, which is to define acts and mental states required for each offense and place limitations upon the condemnation of conduct as criminal when it is without fault, and to give fair warning of the prohibited conduct and penalties. And the legislature, as I said, requires a mental state for complicity liability. The voluntary act is the definition of conduct. That's not a mental state, that's conduct. And I also want to make clear, I'm not arguing that the prosecution was required to add misdemeanor counts, but just that they had the opportunity to, because we brought this to their attention early on. I think they would have had a very good argument that all of this conduct still would have came into evidence. All we wanted was for them to specify and elect an act. And I just want to say one final point, that it's in a case like this with emotional and upsetting facts where we really need all of the procedural protections of the law. Thank you.
Also, thank you for the fine arguments. The case will be submitted. Case stands submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.